Hi, I'm Craig Robinson, and I play Daryl Philbin on The Office.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to a brand new episode of The Office Deep Dive, this time with the hardest working man in showbiz. Nope, not our guest, me, your host, Brian Baumgartner. Just kidding. You'll get that after you listen to the episode. Today, as you just heard, I'm bringing on possibly the most ambitious and certainly the most competent employee at Dunder Mifflin. That's right. The voice of reason in all of the insanity, the incredible Craig Robinson. Like so many of the characters on The Office, a lot of the inspiration, as you'll hear, for Daryl Philbin came from Craig's real personality. He is an incredible musician and a hilarious comedian. Greg Daniels actually discovered him by seeing him perform perhaps one of the greatest comedy songs of all time. Somebody's f***ing my lady. Now, despite the name, and despite the fact that Craig admits to singing his way into booty calls, he insists that his act is a great place to take a date. And I agree. I highly recommend it. Craig is amazing. In addition to his work on The Office, he's gone on to work on many other amazing projects, from Brooklyn Nine-Nine to Hot Tub Time Machine to Cleveland Show and American Dad. I know you've all been waiting to hear from him, and I am so excited that today is finally the day, even though he didn't teach me any super cool new phrases like dink and flicka. But before we dive in, just wanted to give you a quick reminder that the world's best book, if I do say so myself, or holiday present or late night reading is already available right now for pre-order on Amazon. It is called Welcome to Dunder Mifflin, The Ultimate Oral History of The Office. So go check that out and get ready to be overtaken with your love for the show. But for now, the time has come to welcome our very own warehouse foreman and my good friend, Craig Robinson.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every moment left over from the night before.
What's up? How you doing?
Hey, you know, I'm all right. So?
I mean, I'm good.
Yeah?
It's been so long since I saw you.
How long?
I mean,
a couple of years?
It's been a few.
What's new in your life?
I mean, I'm doing this right now. Yeah. I'm on the road a lot. You?
Oh, yeah. I do comedy. You
know. Yeah.
Is this thing on?
Yeah, it's probably on.
We start already?
Well, not really.
Tell the truth, man.
I mean, it's recording, but I'm just interested in
saying
chatting.
What's up. Okay. Check, 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 check.
Are you checking your sound?
Yeah.
Are you a sound expert? Well, you're a musician,
well,
so
like
yeah.
To, I mean, I don't know if it's going louder or softer. There it is.
Did I ever tell you the story? This is before, I think we had done the pilot only. And I hadn't been in LA very long. Did I ever tell you going the M Bar story? For real. I went to the M Bar and they used to do like an open mic night.
Okay.
And somebody was like, oh, go to the M Bar. I think I knew someone who was like a server there. And I remember it was David Cross was there and Sarah Silverman, some other people, and you. You were so far and away the funniest thing I saw that night. Well, you had a guy with
me and
you.
Jerry. Yeah, I think me and Jerry did it.
Bro. Yeah.
Yeah.
But how many shows do you do a year?
I mean, how many cities or shows? Shows are like, you know, 5, sometimes 7 a weekend. So I probably do 30 plus weeks a year.
Jesus.
If I'm not filming something.
So you're the hardest working man in show business?
Not by a long shot.
Okay, so rewind back like 2003, 2004. What were you doing before The Office came on?
Stand up, doing much stand up, and you know, I had some parts here and there. Did a show called Lucky.
Yep,
I was on FX, and then
great show.
Thank you, Connie. Yeah, that was lightning in a bottle right there, man. And then, yeah, it was what, 2001 we started? 2004?
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, so Lucky, and then a bunch of stand-up, I'm not sure.
Did you do Second City?
Yeah, in Chicago. Yeah, I did the training center. I didn't do the...
Okay.
I just went through all the classes, and then moved to LA.
Okay. You incorporate music a lot into your stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that Daryl being a musician on the show, did that come from you? Do you think the writers wrote that?
Absolutely. Yeah. We were like a towel being wrung out. They got whatever they knew we could do, they got it out of us.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You started pretty early. I mean, I remember the Christmas episode, you and I think we were DJing in the corner, and then gradually you started.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I remember that.
Jesus.
We had like what do you call those little balls with the lights and
disco ball.
Disco ball, obviously. I mean, for people who don't know, music comes very easy to you.
Yes.
I have seen people hum you tunes and you start playing.
Well, I mean, trained ear.
Is it trained or is it natural?
I mean, both. You had to sit down and like there was a time I was sitting like play a song and let's break down note for note each chord, rewind it, play it again, rewind it, play it again until I got each chord, and then go through the whole song. And then once you do that, you know, sometimes you can start, you know, see patterns and, you know, see what's going on in the song.
So that's how you learned?
Mm-hmm.
Do you read music?
Yeah.
But how you taught?
Not like I can hear music. It take me a while to read some music, but I can hear pretty good.
You hear better than anyone I've ever seen.
Okay.
No, I'm just saying. I know.
I don't know who you've seen.
Well, right.
But
you trained yourself to do that. I think people think about it as being sort of a natural gift, but no, you.
It's definitely a gift, but it's you know, it's a gift you have to work for. It's like you gotta know you had the talent to do it, and then just develop that.
Right. I remember. Later on, they kept pairing me with you and Ed Helms in musical situations.
What was our group? The Zits?
Kevin and the Zits.
Kevin and the Zits.
There was Kevin and the Zits. And I remember we would, you know, we never had time to read the episodes before we did them.
Right.
And we would read the episodes, and they would be like, song, song, song. And I don't know if you knew this, I would go to them and I would be like, okay, when is rehearsals? When is rehearsals? And then I would come to you and I'd be like, all right, you guys, can we? And you'd be like, yeah, yeah, no, we're good. We're good. And Ed'd be the same way. Like, Ed's like, no, no, it's fine. No, I got it. And I was like, no, 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 guys, I don't have it. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. There's a quote that has been attributed to you, which that you basically started doing music because there were so many funny people in Chicago that you wanted to do something that was different in a way. Is that true?
Not exactly.
Okay.
I just, you know, I it's my thing. And I had the song that I did in college that transferred over to the stage. I would like play, you know, piano. Say I'm singing to a girl on the phone, you know, singing it nice and like talking to her, singing to her a little bit, you know, it's romantic. And I hit up with it. Can I have some booty? Right. And then I was like, okay, now I'm listening to see if she's laughing or what. So if she's laughing, I'm like, okay, we good. But so then I did that like a, I don't know, some open mic kind of thing, but it wasn't an open mic. It was like, you know, actors in a room on a Friday night, like,
right.
You know, and then you just did what you do. So then once I started doing comedy, I went up and did this show, and it didn't go too well. It was this thing called Heckler's Heaven. It's in Chicago, and you get 8 minutes to perform. The first 3 minutes, nobody gets to mess with you. From the third minute on, if people wanted to heckle you, there are three people in the audience who have rubber chickens. If you got all three rubber chickens, you had to get off stage.
Okay.
And then the other three people have scorecards. So I got two rubber chickens the first night. And before I got to third, I was like, I'm not getting a third chicken. I said, good night. Then the next week, I came back with my keyboard. And that was all she wrote.
You did the song that ends with your buddy getting the phone.
Somebody's fucking my lady.
Somebody's fucking my lady, yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody's fucking my lady.
Yeah, that's what you saw at M-Bar, I'm sure.
That's what I saw at M-Bar.
Yeah.
It was one of the funniest
things I've ever seen. That's what got me. Like, they got me in front of Apatow. They got me in front of Greg Daniels.
Really?
Yeah, when I did my audition for The Office, Greg Daniels was like, doesn't get any funnier than that. I was like, okay, now audition. Like, oh, what? Like, it seems like a big vote of confidence, right?
Right.
I'm thinking like, oh, man, well, what do I do now?
So you do Lucky, and then you're doing stand-up. And then how did you know about The Office before you came on?
I saw the British pilot on an airplane.
Okay.
And I was dying, right? And I was like, damn, I wish I could find that, you know? And one day I was like driving past 7-Eleven, and I saw the picture of David Brent. I was, that's the dude from that show, yeah, you know?
Right.
And then I ended up getting the... you know, audition. No, I didn't know much about it except for that pilot.
Right.
That I saw.
And when you got the audition, did you think it was just for one episode, or were they saying like, you may come around a bit?
No, it was just, I mean, it was the first season.
Right.
So you didn't even know, you know,
maybe I was gonna
what was going on. So I just came in and did the audition, and they called me later after y'all got well underway. I was established in episode 4.
Yeah. And did you know Allison Jones before that?
I don't know if I worked with Allison or not before that. No, you know what? Let me see. I think I had gotten 40-year-old, no, I'm sorry, knocked up. How did I do that? Everybody does that to me. 40-year-old virgin. I'd be like, no, it's knocked up. It's knocked up. And I just messed it up. I auditioned for 40-year-old virgin, but I didn't get that. But I did get knocked up, so I'm not sure exactly when it
happened. Which one happened?
Yeah,
right.
Happened first.
But did you know that it was had the possibility to recur at that point, or?
Zero idea. I was just doing a job, man.
Right. What was different for you, or was there anything different for you in terms of the way that the show was shot?
Yeah, oh, that was way different. Like, everything else was like a movie was, you know, the two cameras doing a thing. But nobody was swinging cameras around.
Right. I feel like Daryl, you know, even from the beginning, had kind of a gym thing with the camera. Like, it felt like you were on the same page. Like, you would do the looks to the camera. Like, did you just see that idiot?
I don't get a lot of camera looks till later. But people do say, yeah, see me as a voice of reason in all the insanity.
Yeah. Ben Silverman says that you were the smartest person who worked at Dunder Mifflin. Well, no, not you, but Daryl.
Right. I can see that.
Yeah.
Daryl was just trying to, you know, be honest, make an honest buck, and couldn't believe a lot of things that was going around him. And, you know, he knew he had to keep the peace and knew he had to keep his job.
Yeah.
So I don't think he ever thought, I'm smarter than these cats. He just was, you know, just like, would you believe these cats? You know.
But it felt like, you know, they showed a lot that the warehouse maybe was run more efficiently than the regular office. Like you were good at your job.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Daryl's relationship with Michael in the show, it was a very, like, he kept coming to you for advice, particularly on black culture. It was a very, very funny dynamic. What was your experience working with Steve?
He's the greatest. The way he could turn that comedy button off and on like a faucet was just genius to me. Whenever I had a scene with him, oh man, that was like titillation. It was like, oh, you know, very exciting. And I learned from him, stole from him, all of that.
Yeah. It's funny that you said that, because I thought you were going to say something else, which I think is also true, is part of his genius is how he turns so quick, even within a scene. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like he is fighting down one path and something may happen and he just turns it like that.
And he's like, you know, the ultimate scene partner too. He listens and reacts to, you know, what's going on. Like we had a scene that I didn't even really notice until it aired. It was a negotiation.
Okay.
That might be my favorite episode just because the work I did with Steve and being able to play with him like that. It was a scene where he's like, I'm not going to speak first. Like, right. Decline to speak first. So we did a couple takes and it was fine. Da, da, da. And then he did this next take and he started making these faces. And if you look closely, you can see Meek start to crack a smile on that. But it was just like, without even speaking, he could, you know, pull this out of you. The laughter is like, oh, he's about to get me. But also in that episode, when I was saying the way he listens and, you know, like the perfect improvisation partner, you listen and then take it to the next level. So we were talking about, you know, getting a raise from Jan. I said, make it happen, Captain. And he said, I will, Sergeant. I'm like, God damn, this is amazing.
Do you think that your relationship with him evolved throughout the show?
Yeah, but I think everybody evolved in that show. Everybody went through character development. You know, that's one of the things that makes it what it is. You know, people got to know these people.
Right.
But yeah, I think every situation evolved to something.
I mean, you started out and your episodes were mainly about like the office versus the warehouse, whether directly in basketball or like a weird class thing where you have like the white collar and the blue collar. Talk to me about the transition for you, character-wise or as an actor, of you finally coming up and being a regular part of like the bullpen.
Character-wise, it felt like it did in real life. Like, oh man, they're making you a regular.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So it was definitely a move on up for Craig and for Daryl.
Right.
You know, and it was like more responsibility. And Rain used to say I had the sweetest schedule in Hollywood because I would come in for like an episode here and then 4 weeks later I come in and do the Christmas episode. And,
right.
But yeah, character-wise, it was like, yeah, a step up and, oh, okay, they're starting to see, you know, starting to feel me. And for Craig, myself, it was like, hey, this is awesome. Like, because I didn't understand. Like, I thought we were year to year, like every other show, you know.
Right.
You don't know. But it was something about The Office. Like I remember one year, they were like, Mindy was like, yeah, we're going to be dating. And it didn't happen for a year, and I kind of forgot about it. And the next year, we were dating. I was like, oh, that's interesting. How'd y'all know we're going to be picked up, you know?
Right.
I guess you don't know, but you do, that kind of thing. I wasn't. You know, none of those conversations.
Right. So one of the people that I've talked to is this TV critic, and she talked about The Office. One of the things that was notable about it was that she defined it as casually diverse. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like The Office in terms of race or your experience, do you feel like it did something right or wrong in terms of that?
It presented us as people, and that's all right with me. I don't know that it's right or wrong. I think casually diverse is a great way to put it. But it just, you know, we were regular. We looked like a real office. We weren't like, you know, models walking around
right
with soap opera dialogue. This was like, just, okay, these are people with, some of them probably have some mentally ill problems that they need to take care of.
Right. But
they're unleashed on society.
Right.
And it's fine.
Do you think the show did anything in terms of a positive message in terms of diversity or race? I mean, you were nominated for 3 NAACP awards.
Correct. Lost all 3 though. Nick Cannon, Ice Cube, and somebody else. But I mean, people from all walks of life love The Office. So I wish I could speak to that specifically. Some, you know, somebody would be like, you know what, I had a problem with black people, but since that show, you know, I don't know.
Right.
Like, I just don't know that answer.
You know what's funny? This is kind of a side note. Someone pointed this out that in Christmas Party, we were talking about before season 2, Michael tells Daryl that he can't wear a Santa hat. And 8 years later, Megyn Kelly, there was a controversy was started by
Santa Claus's white kids.
Yeah. Like he was, before anyone ever knew who Megyn Kelly was, he was making a joke out of what she would say in the future.
Right. Calling America out.
Yeah. Do you do that in your comedy?
Race?
Yeah.
Stuff?
Or just about America?
No, not really.
No.
I have a date act. My act is mostly for like...
lovers?
It's a great date night. I mean, it's for everybody, but it's couples get, I don't know, a boost out of it.
A boost? Like a sexual boost?
Something.
You give a sexual boost?
Something to your definitely audience? Happens, yeah. I'm definitely about the, you know, the relationship vibe.
Interesting. I wonder what my vibe is. I don't think it's that. Daryl eventually interviews to be the new manager. Did you want that job?
No.
Why?
I just didn't. They were talking about me being in it. And one time I went up to Paul. I was like, hey, man, just put that in your pocket. I gave him $1. Like, when you're thinking about the new manager. But I did not want to be manager. I thought that was interesting that my name got brought up and it was cool. And, you know, I thought about it, what that would be like and all of that. But no, it seemed like I looked like a lot of work.
Way different than Rain talking about your schedule coming in one episode and being gone for 4. Yeah.
But the path to that, was amazing. Someone go, Kathy Bates and
Will Ferrell.
Will, James.
James Spader.
Jeez Louise. I look back at some of those episodes, I'm like, that's right. That actually happened.
Yeah.
Spader was incredible, man. God damn.
Yeah. How was it like working with, you know, once Steve left, working with those guys?
I mean, these are legends coming in and you're just like hanging out, you know, going by the trailer. Oh, what's up? How you doing? Catherine Tate. Who I don't know anything about till I met her then. That's my homie still to this day. She's the best.
Spader, how was working with Spader different than Steve?
Well, I mean, you know, Spader, how do you describe the guy? He's his own world. He's his own, I don't know. He was cool. He was real cool. He was, you know, chatty, you know, say what's up and smooth with it. But, you know, he's got that weird, creepy funny. And Steve was just like a faucet of just whatever you needed. And then Spader, they wrote to him beautifully.
Yeah, it was just interesting how they just approached it in a totally opposite way.
Yeah.
From like really wanting a crafted acting performance to way more sort of improv, facile.
Exactly.
Yeah. You were talking before about the leading up to Daryl becoming the manager and getting to work with all of those people. I mean, that was a huge storyline for you. I mean, and then eventually you going off and working with Jim. Do you think today Daryl would still be working with Jim at the
Athlete? Oh yeah. They'd be at all the, you know, dope games and killing it. Heck yeah. But I mean, I'm sure he would have found another way to rise by this point. But Maybe it was in his own company. Who knows? Daryl's ambitious.
Yeah. Ben, again, going back to Ben's talking about Daryl being the smartest person in the office, but he was overlooked a lot. Sort of like, you know, like Kevin was overlooked in the basketball episode. Like Michael's like, oh yeah, of course that guy can't play. And then, you know, you
swish.
Exactly. Daryl,
no, you really are an athlete.
Huh? I am.
I mean, we had a softball team.
Oh, that's right.
You killed, bro.
Oh, I forgot about that.
You was a beast.
That's right. Runs
and stuff. We were like, dang, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, B.
Just don't make me run that fast. That's all. Just hit it far enough. So that was the thing. Hit it far enough so I don't have to run so fast. Yeah, but it felt like Daryl kept being overlooked, at least by Michael.
I mean, he was in the warehouse. He wasn't, trying to be looked at, I guess.
What was your negotiation? Was that your favorite episode?
Probably, yeah. Just the sheer amount of work Mike and I did. And they said, people said I'm the only one that called him Mike.
That's right.
I didn't even realize that.
Yeah. You were the only one who called him Mike. What was it like for you working with Krasinski? How was he different than Steve? I mean, he's a pain in the ass, but other than that.
What's all that? John always struck me. I mean, he just knew. Like, he felt like he was, you know, just brilliant dude, you know? I love his directing. And he's funny, you know, when he wanted to be, but he was the more the leading man kind of dude.
Yeah.
But no, he was always cool, man. He was great.
In the finale, do you remember what happens in the finale?
No.
We all go back to Scranton like a year later and we do that Q&A panel on the show.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and Ellie and her parents are there.
Oh, my God, I'm going to cry thinking about that.
Yeah.
Joan Cusack.
Was it sad?
Sad to watch. I know. In that moment with Ellie, and because I didn't know what was going on.
Right.
Yeah, that was pretty, heart-wrenching.
Well, and Creed singing the song, All the Faces. He sings that. Yeah, and then Jenna takes the painting off the wall and goes outside.
Oh, yeah, I do remember that moment.
Jen Salata talked about that Greg used to talk about the show was like a giant parking lot that goes on forever. Like as far as you can see, there's just asphalt everywhere. And then just line, parking space, handicap space. That just goes on and on. He said, but then when you start to look closer, you see the little cracks in the parking lot. And every once in a while, there's just a little teeny flower that comes up out of the ground. And that examining that beauty in a wasteland was what the show was trying to do. I think that's why it relates to people.
One of the many reasons, of course. Have you ever seen Greg go into his own?
Like what?
So we were doing this show. This wasn't the office. It was
Mr. Robinson?
Mr. Robinson, yeah. So we had the pitch, like the big pitch was like later on in the day. And Kasky was there. Tracy, shout out Tracy. And she had to move. She was like, Greg, we got to go. And Greg went into this feverish, fierce, like you saw his brain working. He started writing and banging his thing. And it was like watching Michelangelo paint or something. It was like, oh, this is happening right now in front of me. Dude is incredible. Salute Greg Daniels.
Yeah.
When he was going into his writing mode and Kasky was trying to say, Greg, we got, he almost like, you know, like he was typing. It was amazing, bro.
Wow. He was just, he had an idea and he had to get it done.
Dude, I swear, it was like watching Harry Potter or something. It was magic. It was like a whirlwind around him. And he almost barked at her when she tried to get him to go. Yeah.
Is he the smartest comedy person you know?
Yes. I'm going to have to say absolutely. I do love working with Greg. I mean, he could be a nicer guy, you know, and then smartest dude in every room.
Yeah. What are you most thankful for The Office?
You know, when you meet people, it's this genuine, like it feels like you have friends everywhere. And that's a big part of my life. Cause you know, these friends come out, they support my shows and what have you. And it's a lot of like the deeper it goes, you know, people have these stories of, you know, my mother had cancer and, you know, we watched The Office and, you know, we got through this, and it'll be these incredible, heart-wrenching stories about our family. We don't talk, but we bond over The Office. You know, I think you were asking me, you was like, why the hell is this show still relevant? And I think that's a big part of it. People really connect through the show with family members or whoever.
Right. Why do you think it resonates? I mean, here was my impression anyway, that people were like, oh, The Office. Yeah, people can relate because 60 million people work in offices around the country. So, of course, now, like, it's young people who are young really people. Into it.
Soldiers, for sure, man. Yeah, and then young people, like, starting it, and then people are like, yeah, I'm on my ninth time around watching it, or we watched it, you know, three times or four times. You know, it's a phenomenon. I don't know how to put my finger on it. I think that awkwardness, you know, it's got everything. It's got humor, awkward. It's got heart. You fall in love with people. And, you know, it's a beautiful show.
Yeah. All right, guys, do we need anything else from Mr. Robinson here?
No, I think that's it, Brad.
Good. Thanks, buddy.
You're welcome, sir.
Dude, it's been so crazy. I've seen everyone. John, Jenna, Rain.
I'm sure Steve. This is the most boring interview.
No.
Easily. I know. No. I'm suck at these things, but it's good.
Ladies and gentlemen, the man himself, Craig Robinson. Craig, it's so good to see you. And I think we can all agree that you're anything but boring. Thank you for taking the time to stop by. And thank you, my favorite listeners, for tuning in. You're in luck because today we've got a double whammy of a release. So make sure you go check out round two of my conversation with director Ken Kwapis right now. I will see you over there. The Office Deep Dive is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Leng Li. Our senior producer is Tessa Kramer. Our producers for this episode are Liz Hayes and Diego Tapia. My main man in the booth is Alec Moore. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by my great friend Creed Bratton, and the episode was mixed by Seth Olansky.